Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Representative Chrissy Houlihan's telephone town hall focused today on the Delta variant. Sorry we're a few minutes late. We had a few technical difficulties, but we're here now. We've got a lot of people on the line, so let's just get started. For everybody calling in, if you have a question at any point throughout this town hall, please press star 3. Again, if you have any questions throughout the town hall, please press star 3. You'll be transferred to a member of Chrissy's staff who will take down your question and enter it into the queue. We have a lot of people on the line, and we want to get to as many questions as possible. So, again, as soon as you've got one, press star 3. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Congresswoman Houlihan.
Thank you, Connor, and good morning to everyone, and thank you all for joining us for our telephone town hall today, which is focused on the Delta variant. Before we dive in, I did want to start with what I believe is the most important message that we have to take home today, which is that vaccines that we have work. They work against the Delta variant. They are saving lives every single day, and they are our strongest tool that we have to beat this virus once and for all. So I would encourage everyone who's able to get vaccinated to get vaccinated. As many of us might know, our community has been a leader, not just in the Commonwealth, but also in the country in terms of very high vaccination rates, and we need to keep it up. In Congress, I've recently joined an effort that will demand answers from the FDA about plans to approve the vaccine for children under 12. And this is a very important step as we safely navigate back to school season as well. And I'll continue to work with my colleagues and with public health officials and medical experts to provide you up-to-date information and advanced policy that will save both lives and our livelihoods as well. Many of you have reached out to our office with concerns about the Delta variant. Since the start of this pandemic, we have been adamant that our office is a resource for you, the people of our community. And that's why I've invited a medical doctor and public health official to join us for today for this town hall. They are the experts, and they are who we should be listening to. On the line today, we have Dr. Benjamin Abella, who is the attending physician and vice chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine at Penn Medicine. We also have Jean Franklin, the public health director of Chester County Health Department. And these two experts have joined our town halls multiple times in the past, and I want to start by thanking them profusely on behalf of our community for their guidance and help. I know there has been misinformation about this virus from the beginning, and I believe that it is the responsibility of our leaders to quash this misinformation and to have faith in our community that we can all handle the truth. So the point of these town halls is so that you, the members of our community, have the opportunity to ask our experts questions. So as Connor has mentioned, if at any point in time you do have a question for our panel, please do press star 3. And with that, I'd like to hand it over to Dr. Abella for his introduction and remarks. Over to you, Dr. Abella.
Good morning, Chrissy, and good morning, everyone. I'm glad to be here, although it's an unfortunate reason to be here. So a bit about me briefly. I'm a physician at Penn Medicine. I'm in the emergency department there, where I have led a number of COVID-related projects. So I've certainly become well-informed about COVID over the last year and a half. Now, a little bit about the Delta variant, because I think that's one of our main areas of interest today. So the Delta variant, also known as B1.617.2, is a variant of the COVID-19 virus that has now been around in the United States at least for several months, arguably since March of this year. What is remarkable about this variant of the virus, it has pretty much taken over all new infections. So the great majority of new infections in the United States are now from the Delta variant. So when we talk about COVID infection in the U.S., at this point, we're pretty much talking about Delta variant infection. Now, the Delta variant is far more contagious than the older variant, the more common variant that used to be prevalent. It is not clear if it's more deadly. It seems to have about the same rate of hospitalization, same rate of bad outcomes as with other previous versions of the COVID virus. But the most important take-home message, it's more contagious. It's highly contagious.
Yeah, I'm on.
And usually, sorry? Oh, sorry, I heard somebody speaking there. It is more contagious, and it is contagious in the same way. So it's through droplets, through being in close contact and aerosolization from breathing, which is why masking is so important. Now, to give a little sense of where we are in Pennsylvania, cases are certainly climbing around the state. This morning I spent some time looking over the data, and it's pretty diffuse across the state. So it's not that certain areas are hotspots in our state, but rather across the board we're seeing increases. The increases in infection in Pennsylvania are nowhere near as bad as what they are in the southern states. And one small note of positive I can bring to the call today, the health systems in Pennsylvania are not overwhelmed as of yet. We, for example, at Penn Medicine and many other health systems, there are certainly upticks in COVID hospitalizations. However, we have capacity. We can, right now, we can manage. And that leads me, to the most important point I would make, which is we need to keep it that way. Right now it's manageable. We need to stay ahead of this. And one of the best ways to do it, to emphasize and underscore what Representative Houlihan was saying, vaccines work. We need to increase our vaccination rates. The vaccine rates are still relatively low in Pennsylvania. In Chester County right now, the rates of full vaccination are around 56%. In Montgomery County, it's around 51%. Pennsylvania more broadly, 53%. And the rates are much lower in younger folks. So people in their 30s and 40s have lower vaccination rates. We need to encourage them to get vaccinated. Vaccination is free. So beware of any scammers who are charging for vaccination. Through federal support, vaccination is free. If you need to find a place to get vaccinated, you can text your zip code to 438829. That's 438829. It's a service where if you text your zip, you'll get a list of local vaccination sites. Or you can call 800-232-0233. That's 1-800-232-0233. So finding a vaccination site and financial support for vaccination should not be barriers to getting vaccination. It's incredibly safe. And what vaccines do is they lower the chance of death or hospitalization by an enormous amount. So it has often been said in the media that right now this COVID Delta variant new epidemic, this new wave, is really a wave of the unvaccinated. And that is true. When you look at the hospitalizations and deaths from Delta, well over 95%, really well over 98% in most locations, are an unvaccinated people. So if you're vaccinated, you still can catch Delta variant, but your chance of being hospitalized or seriously ill are dramatically lower, which is why it's so important. And then my final comment, and then I'll turn it back, is about masking. It is so important that we mask. And our Governor Wolf recently said he was not going to impose a statewide mask mandate. Many states have imposed statewide mandates. For example, in Louisiana with the Democratic governor, they've done so. And it's very important. Why do I say that? Because of schools. Schools are starting up. School children under 12 are unvaccinated because right now the vaccine is only approved for people over 12. And I'll tell you that just this morning I learned that in Palm Beach, Florida, on the second day of school, 440 students are already quarantined for positive COVID tests. And so I really believe that we need our school children masked. Better to go to school in a mask than to have school go virtual for yet another year. And with that, those opening remarks, I'll turn it back to our team here.
Thanks, Dr. Abella. And now I'd like to reintroduce Jean Franklin, Chester County, for Chester County's response on the Delta variant and other initial comments before we go to questions.
Thank you, Representative, and good morning and happy Friday to everyone. Thank you for joining us. I think these opportunities to have an open forum are very, very important. So I appreciated everything Dr. Abella had shared, and so I'll just add maybe a little bit more and then leave, our time to the questions. So the health department is, kind of back where we were, just on a different scale about this time last year, quite frankly, in that we are, reestablishing our teams to ensure that we have the support for schools, child care, long-term cares, our county prison, et cetera. So all of that has not stopped. It's just re-ramping up to a higher level. And in that, what is very different this year is that all of the guidance is out in advance, earlier than it was last year. And thankfully, the majority of the guidance is all in line with each other. So by Chester County you know, leadership and the health department indicating that it is following CDC's guidance, it's signaling that from a public health standpoint, that guidance is spot on and is useful. So continuing to promote the vaccine. I would like to say, you know, and this is part of our myth-busting, you know, opportunities is, you know, we hear a lot of people saying, why should I bother getting the vaccine if I can get the virus still? Well, you should bother because of what Dr. Abella has already shared, that, you know, the vaccine is going to reduce the duration, the severity, the potential to be hospitalized, and, you know, the potential for death. And it, you know, with fewer people unvaccinated, the opportunity for a new variant to spin up is, frankly, kind of squashed. But we also have to remember, the vaccines were never designed to get rid of COVID. They were designed to minimize COVID's impact. So the vaccines are working. So I echo what, you know, Representative has said and Dr. Abella, they are working, and that's why we should continue it. We don't want a slide to slide back into unmanageable times here in Chester County. So for those of you who are vaccinated, talk to those who aren't vaccinated, because they want to hear from you. They want to hear the, you know, what drove you to do it, why should they consider it. Our biggest goal at the health department around vaccines is ensuring people make an informed choice. We are not here to twist anyone's arm, and we respect some people may not choose to, but we want them to make that with informed choices, not out of fear, not out of social media blitz, not out of misinformation, et cetera. So that's our big ask. Be informed and then make your decision. Certainly masking, we are back promoting masking again. We are establishing additional clinics to open up again. You probably have heard the booster is being going through the final approvals for immunocompromised individuals. That is extremely important. So we're working on that. We have plans in place for when the individuals less than 12 years old have an opportunity to receive vaccine. We among many other providers in Chester County, will ramp up our vaccination efforts to get them vaccinated as quickly as possible. So we're still doing everything we have done, and what is known today and what we need to do today and going forward is exactly what has been consistent through this entire pandemic. So we need to stay the course and help our families and neighbors and friends and communities stay the course as well, because as Representative said, we have done phenomenal here in Chester County, but it's not enough for what this virus is showing us. So I'll end there and eager to take questions. Thank you, Representative.
And thank you very much. And now at this point, I'd like to turn us back over to Connor to go ahead and present any questions that people have had. Reminder, *3 for questions. And also a reminder, since we do have quite a few people on the line, that if for whatever reason we're not able to get to your question today, our staff is taking down your names and numbers, and we'll be getting back to you within 48 hours as well, business hours as well. So back over to Connor.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Representative. Thanks all for joining the line. We're going to get right into these. Our first question today comes from John in Westchester. John, you should now be on the line.
Hi. My question is more geared towards Ms. Franklin. I'm a little confused as to why Chester County Health Department hasn't taken a more definitive stance on mask mandating in schools. Everything you just said makes complete sense to me, and I have four kids, three of whom are 14 or older, and all three of them are vaccinated, as am myself. My 11-year-old, who is rising into middle school, is not eligible to get a vaccine, and he's going to go into sixth grade, where my school district is recommending that if we're in the low or moderate, masking is basically optional, and only when we get into substantial and high categories is masking required. If masking works to stop the spread, I don't understand that. I just am confused as to why the Chester County Health Department is making a recommendation instead of saying just making a mandate that masking is required for school. I don't want to be back in virtual learning, and masking works. So I just want you to explain to me why we're not being more definitive.
Thank you, John, for your question. Ms. Franklin?
Yeah, John, thank you as well for your question. Certainly, it's probably on, you know, the tip of everyone's tongue, your exact question. School boards make school policy. I make broad public health recommendations. While there may be some room for mandates and orders and requirements and, you know, whatever word you want to use, the schools ultimately hold that authority. And in partnering with schools, we have explicitly agreed that they will, you know, they will land on the policy and enforce those policies with the information provided. So I, you know, the schools have, it is a massive operations they run. So for us to come in and, you know, try to enforce or mandate a policy in their environment, when we've been working so cooperatively together, you know, for well over a year now, it just seems it might be a little counter to what we have collectively been working toward. I firmly believe the schools know what to do, know where their strengths are, know what their, layered mitigations, the advantages of the layered mitigations. So I don't at this time have a policy mindset for schools. And that also applies for our restaurants, for our daycares, for our long-term care facilities. And you could see how that starts to just spin, you know, further and further and further into other types of organizations. So I respect your question. I understand that it is, you know, can be confusing and frustrating at times. So thank you, John.
Thank you, Ms. Franklin, and thank you, John. We're going to keep moving right along. Again, reminder to y'all, star 3 if you do have a question. Our next question comes from Rachel in Phoenixville. Rachel, you should now be on the line.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, thank you so much for your work, Representative Houlihan, as well as the special guest. So I want to specifically focus my question towards you, Representative Houlihan. So as someone on the House Foreign Affairs Committee, what would you be doing to address the spread of COVID, not just here but abroad, and then also how will you prevent more variants from developing in unvaccinated or impoverished countries who can't address the pandemic themselves?
Hi, Rachel, and thanks very much for the question. I'll loop back for just a minute to the last question and then get to yours. I would say for those who are concerned, I'm a parent myself, with masking in schools, please do get engaged with your school boards because Jean mentioned, this is where those decisions are made. So make sure that you are, you know, aware of their decision-making process and when they're making decisions on this. Rachel, for your question, you're right. I'm fortunate to be on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and one of the things that we're, you know, hearing in this conversation is that wherever there is COVID, we are all threatened. And so even if Chester County, as an example, is doing, and Burke's doing a better than average job, that doesn't mean that this has become something we don't need to worry about because it's somewhere else. We need to worry about COVID and, frankly, other kinds of diseases like it all the time, wherever it is. And so in terms of what the Foreign Affairs Committee is up to, we are supportive of an organization called COVAX, and COVAX is an organization that helps get the vaccine to other parts of the world, to your point, to parts of the world where people are not necessarily able to access or develop or purchase this vaccine. You probably know that the president has committed to 500 million vaccine doses that would be distributed as a result through COVAX. And we are the largest donor to COVAX and have contributed $3.5 billion so far. So we continue in the Foreign Affairs Committee to think about your other question too, which is what do we do about other variants, or what do we do, frankly, about other diseases or other opportunities for pandemic? And so we're trying to do that through a variety of different legislative initiatives, including one that I recently was a co-sponsor of called Securing America from Epidemics Act. So we're trying to take a look at the lessons learned, real time in this particular experience, to see if we can accelerate vaccines and vaccine development for other diseases that we worry could also be similar to COVID in terms of our vulnerability as a population, not just the U.S., but also internationally as well. So it is one of the things that I'm pretty excited to be able to be helpful on the Foreign Affairs Committee, and one of the things that I think is nice to, you know, have a background in a variety of things, including science and logistics and distribution. So thanks very much for your question, Rachel. Please know that there are quite a few of us on our Foreign Affairs Committee who are working on these issues.
Thank you. Thank you, Rachel, and thank you, Representative. Our next question, moving right along here, is Lou from Kennett Square. Lou, you should now be on the line with us.
Thank you very much for holding the town hall. It sounds from everything I've been reading and listening to that the booster shot is going to become inevitable, far beyond the immunocompromised people. And my question is, we had a bumpy rollout initially, very understandable, for the initial vaccine earlier this year. What have we learned from this, and how is the rollout of a booster shot later this year going to be much smoother so that we don't have to go to an adjoining county or a different state or be on the phone for hours trying to get an appointment?
Thank you so much, Lou, for your question. And just to be clear, I'm looking at the list of questions. There are a few questions regarding boosters, so I want to try and get them all in through this question. The first question is for Dr. Abella, can you sort of explain just the science behind the boosters, why they might be necessary? And then, Ms. Franklin, I'm going to have you answer Lou's questions about the rollout and what we're kind of thinking in terms of our community. But let's start with Dr. Abella on the efficacy and the need for a booster.
Sure. So first off, it's important to point out that the science isn't yet totally clear when a booster would be required or even if a booster would be required. The general concept behind a booster is that immunity may fade somewhat after getting your series of shots. So at some point that still remains really unclear, there may be more breakthrough COVID infections in those who have received proper vaccination. But we don't really know when. And it's certainly right now showing that the current vaccines are still robust. The fact that over 98% of all hospitalizations deaths are in unvaccinated people supports the notion that these vaccines are perhaps more durable than we think. Now, all that being said, I do agree that at some point boosters probably are going to be required as these variants develop that may have more risk of breakthrough infection. So that's the general concept behind boosters. And I'll say also that just yesterday, the FDA has tentatively approved, it's got to still go through the CDC as well, but the FDA has tentatively approved the concept of a third booster shot for a select group of people, for those with immune compromise or other immune problems where immunity may not be as strong. So I agree. I think boosters are coming to some degree. When and how important, it's not so clear. And I do think that we're going to be in much better shape from some of the infrastructural concerns that you're talking about, a lot of lessons have been learned about how to set up pop-up booster clinics, how to establish coordinated access to these. This 1-800 number that I gave earlier, and I'll just say it again because it's so important, 800-232-0233 to find a local vaccination site. So I think we're going to be in much better shape, but I'll leave it to Representative Houlihan and my public health colleague to talk about how the infrastructure in Pennsylvania will support the boosters.
Thanks, Dr. Bella. And Ms. Franklin, can we go over to you then again? Lou's question was about what have we learned from the bumpy rollout, you know, in the past with the first round of vaccines, and how can we improve upon that with the rollout of what looks like a booster coming down the pike here?
Absolutely. What we've learned is we're in a very different position. A lot of the initial bumps in the first rollout was, frankly, related to the availability of a vaccine and how it was coming into the states, et cetera. Vaccine is widely available now. We're not at a shortage. We are not limited in what we can order. The ordering process now is standardized like all of our other vaccines. We have many, many more providers who have, you know, enrolled to be a vaccine or a COVID vaccine provider. So just by sheer numbers of doses available, providers available, and, you know, the locations available, all of our pharmacies are still in it. All of our pharmacies have been approved to vaccinate individuals, you know, younger than 12, which is not typical in pharmacies. So just by that alone, we should experience a very different rollout. Now, that all assumes that there's not going to be any phasing of this rollout where we saw in the beginning, Group A, Group B, you know, age or certain, you know, criteria. I think that just became confusing and overwhelming for the public and for the, you know, healthcare systems trying to deliver that. So, and a big learning beyond what Dr. Abella has shared is the ease at which we can handle walk-ins. Appointments versus walk-in individuals versus appointments. So just the better fluid ability to be more nimble and move the clinics to different locations because some of our clinics are on wheels. Others are these pop-ups that Dr. Abella had mentioned. And then I'll end with just the phenomenal collaboration particularly among our large health systems in Chester County. We are super fortunate here. You know, Penn Medicine, Tower Health, Mainline, as a matter of fact, we're meeting next week to do further planning. Just this whole synergy of willingness to work together, it will certainly improve it. And, you know, beyond just sharing a vaccine. So it is our goal to make this smoother for everybody's sake. Thank you.
You're welcome. And if I could just add to that, I'm really heartened to hear that there are a lot of questions on the line about the booster. And I think that that's really indicative of the interest our community has and always has had in kind of doing our part. I just want to make sure that people also do understand, though, that this booster strategy is not a replacement for the fact that we still do have a large number of people who are unvaccinated and who need to get their first and second shots. So I would please encourage people who are either unvaccinated to consider getting a shot or who know people in your life who have not yet been vaccinated to please have that conversation with them because it is supportive of all of us in our community. And I'll turn it back over to Connor.
Thank you so much, Lou, for the question. Our next question comes from Jane in Chester Springs. Jane, you should now be on the line.
Hi. Thank you for having this symposium. My question is relating to those people who have had COVID. Do we have any data about how immune they are or for how long. I hear a lot of people who are not getting vaccinated because they say that they already had COVID. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Jane, for that question. And there are a few others in the queue to that tenor of the claim that if you've had COVID, you don't need the vaccine. Dr. Bella, could you kind of speak to that question?
Yep, I sure can. It's a very common and important question. So there are very strong data that the immunity generated by having COVID is not nearly as strong as the immunity generated by vaccination. So having had COVID is not sufficient. And I can point you to a very recent study, just came out in July 2021, that looked at military recruits in the United States. So this is even young, healthy people, you know, being recruited to the Marines, it turns out. And they looked at a large cohort of these folks who had had COVID before, and a lot of them got COVID again. So now the ones who are vaccinated got it at fivefold lower rate. So it really mattered, and that's any infection, never mind how severe. So the point being that vaccination still has a very, very strong protective effect among those who've had COVID before. And if you've had COVID before and you remain unvaccinated, your risk is much higher. It's just the immunity is just less successful. And that's the nature of the way vaccines work. They generate a very, very robust immune response against specific proteins that are required to make the virus work. So anyone who's had COVID, you can tell them there are strong data to support getting vaccinated after you've had COVID.
Thank you so much, Dr. Abella, and thank you, Jane, for your question. Our next question comes from Gina. Gina, you should now be on the line.
My question is for Representative Houlihan. The CDC has recommended wearing masks indoors for both vaccinated and unvaccinated people. And I'm concerned because most people in businesses and large social activities are not following this recommendation. So my question is, why aren't our governors in the Philadelphia area supporting that recommendation by implementing mask rules for indoor venues?
Got it. Thank you so much, Gina. I'm actually going to toss that over first to Ms. Franklin to sort of speak to the CDC guidance and how we're starting to see that play out from a public health perspective in our Commonwealth.
Absolutely. So you are correct in the transmission levels of substantial and high. It is recommended that individuals, regardless of vaccination status, wear a mask indoors in public settings. So that is what we support. We are promoting it. I'll let Representative address, you know, whether there's, you know, the governor level of it. So it's one of the proven, you know, it's one of the opportunities an individual can take to protect themselves. And that's really where I think the key aspect of masks come in.
And this is Chrissy Houlihan. This is such a complicated question, and I very much appreciate it and the spirit with which it's asked. It is incredibly frustrating that we don't necessarily have the levers that we'd like to have at a federal level or a state level to make the mandates that I believe are necessary. And please believe me when I say I'm doing everything that I can with all the levers that I have to have conversations with our elected officials at all different levels, both federally and statewide and locally, to ask for the best thing that we can do, which is to wear masks and to, you know, be vaccinated. And so it is a very complicated, beautiful part of our nation that makes the fact that all these decisions aren't made in an autocratic way. But it is something that I think is probably very frustrating to many of us. And thank you so much for your question.
Thank you, Gina. And our next question is from Bob in Oxford. Bob, you should now be on the line with us.
Well, thank you. I'm interested in hearing about how many people get sick from being vaccinated. I've talked to people who are avoiding vaccination because they are afraid that the process of being vaccinated will make them sick. And can you give us some rundown on the numbers there?
Got it. Thank you, Bob, for that question. Just, I think you cut off a little bit, but the question he asked was about people getting sick from the vaccine. What numbers do we have? What data do we have? And sort of how to deal with that issue. Dr. Bella, can you speak to that, please?
I sure can. And certainly it's important to point out this is a very, very common concern. We hear this often, that people are scared, people are worried about getting sick and the consequences of the vaccine. The most important frontline thing I can tell you is the data are overwhelming regarding the safety of the COVID-19 vaccine and vaccination in general. So first, it's important to point out that many people will feel the effects of the vaccine. Many people will have a couple of days of feeling achy or a little bit of arm discomfort or even sometimes a fever, especially with the second shot and the two-shot series. This is common. It just means the immune system is working. And this is many people have this with other vaccines, so this is not something that's unfamiliar. Many people feel a little bit unwell after the flu vaccine. It always passes, just takes a couple of days, and some people feel no side effects whatsoever. Now, the more serious concerns that have been talked about in the media, for example, this concern about myocarditis, it's important to share real facts about that. So this has been looked at extensively, and the rate of myocarditis after the COVID vaccines in a recent study is literally 1 in 100,000. So incredibly rare. In this large post-market analysis, there were 20 cases of viral post-vaccine myocarditis, and all 20 recovered and no one died. So there have been no deaths documented in any of the vaccine series of myocarditis deaths, and the rate is incredibly small. By the way, much smaller than the rate of myocarditis with COVID infection itself. COVID can cause myocardial heart inflammation, and it can be very serious. The vaccine does not. So the fears are understandable. I know where people are coming from. These things can be scary, but the data are really, really strongly in support of the safety of this vaccine.
Thank you, Dr. Abella, for that, and thank you, Bob, for the question. Our next question comes from Charles in Westchester. Charles, you should now be on the line with us.
Hello, thank you. A question about vaccinating young people, particularly kids. Just some confusion on my part. I think Dr. Abella touched on it earlier. The vaccination rates are low in those under 30, primarily. But you know, I'm a numbers guy. I look at a lot of the numbers, and I'm worried that children, and particularly younger children, vaccinating them, I haven't seen a lot of data on the safety for vaccinating kids, which might be why it's not available yet for 12 and under. But also, I feel ultimately the goal is to avoid the worst outcome, which is death. And there's been very few in that group under 30. I looked on the PA Department of Health site yesterday, and there were a total of 70 deaths in the whole state under the age of 30. So it's just a question about, do we really need to vaccinate kids in this process?
Got it. Thank you, Charles, for that question. Dr. Bella, why don't we start with you a little bit on that question about children and vaccines for that rate, group of under 30, then, of course, under 12 as well.
Sure. So it's a very good question. Children can suffer significant consequences, and death isn't the only one. You know, there's a lot of lung scarring and damage that can occur, and what a tragedy if we have a 12-year-old or 14-year-old who could get vaccinated, who doesn't, who gets COVID, and then is a pulmonary cripple for years to come. Now, those rates are certainly higher than the death rates. We don't have a great handle on that yet, but that's one reason. But honestly, the more important, bigger reason why children really need to get vaccinated is the herd immunity question. So kids may not have serious consequences from COVID, and young adults may not have serious consequences at the same rate. And I think that drives a lot of their desire not to get vaccinated. They say, well, I'm young, I'm healthy, I'll be fine. So first off, they may not be, but more importantly, they live with people who are older. They have friends, possibly, with people who are older. And so it's the community spread, which is really the issue. If you have a big group of people who are in their 30s who don't get vaccinated, people in their 30s are social. They have friends. They go out. They visit their parents or grandparents. And they put everyone around them at huge risk because they're much more likely to have low-grade infection or even asymptomatic infection, and there's really good data that they will spread the virus. So the danger here is we're going to have a cohort of 30-year-olds who are going to get COVID who will do well personally, but will shed the virus everywhere they go, including to vulnerable people, maybe their grandparents with cancer, maybe their uncle who has HIV, maybe other family members who can't get vaccinated because they have other medical conditions. So that's really the big reason why it's so crucial that young adults get vaccinated.
And if I could just add a little bit to that as well, I think that we all are driven by numbers and data, and I think that scientific process and integrity is critical to all of this. And we're trying, you know, from our perspective in the Congress, to make sure that we are asking the right questions in the right order in the right time frame to make sure that with every step that we take, the vaccine continues to be safe and effective, and we know who can have it and who can't have it. My understanding is that there will be an announcement from Pfizer in the near future, in the September timeframe, about moving the vaccine to be able to be used for children ages 5 to 11 in the later part of September. We expect that announcement. Ages 2 to 5 shortly after that, and under 2 sometime in October or November, we expect that from Pfizer possibly. Moderna and J&J haven't communicated timelines for any of that, but part of our job in the Congress of Oversight is making sure that we're asking all those questions and doing the work of the people to make sure that we're being thoughtful in the rollout of these successful vaccines. Back to Connor.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Charles. We have time, y'all, for about 2 more questions, so I'm going to go straight to Kay in Westchester. Kay, you should now be on the line.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm looking for a response to friends who say that cloth masks don't work. So why should they wear them, and especially why should kids wear them in school if cloth masks don't protect you? So I'd like to be able to respond to that with information and data. Could you help me?
Yeah, thank you, Kay, for the question. Sorry, we got cut off there a second. But yes, why don't we start with Ms. Franklin from a public health perspective, and then we'll go to Dr. Bella for, like, the actual data on do cloth masks work.
So I think it's pretty clear that masks work, and certainly masks that are cloth, if it is more of that cotton-based cloth that works, and, you know, I apologize. It seems so simple to me, but the material of the mask certainly benefits how well a mask works. I mean, everybody already understands the N95s for healthcare providers, et cetera. It is when the mask material is allows too much air, so the fibers are too far apart, if you will. Hence, that's why we promote the more of the cotton-based. I think Dr. Abella could probably speak to how the different types of masks work in addition to the data. There's a lot of studies out there on this. Be happy to share some. I know we've looked at some ourselves as masking was becoming, the key thing last year. Thank you.
Yeah, it's a good question, and I can tell you that that there has been some confusion around cloth masks in particular. The data are very strong that cloth masks work. There have been at least 10 major community-based studies that have clearly shown that any form of masking works, including cloth masking. I think some of this confusion may have been there were some older studies, by older, I mean 2020, it's amazing how quickly things progress, that suggested that cloth masks may not offer much benefit. But here's the problem. They were small studies. They didn't have proper control groups. They weren't conducted well. The problem was they were picked up in the media because, you know, what the media's bias is to do things that generate clicks and to pick breathless sort of things. And so there were two studies that called the question cloth masks. But since then, large community-based studies have clearly shown that community transmission is stopped by cloth masks. And so, for example, one large study in the U.S. Showed that if communities that showed a 10% increase in mask wearing of any kind, including predominantly cloth masks, the chance of stopping community transmission was tripled. So there's very strong data that any mask helps. And the science behind this is that a large proportion of COVID transmission is through aerosols. And aerosols are basically somewhat large, you know, large relatively speaking, you know, millimeter, half millimeter size, water droplets, basically, with COVID inside, and cloth masks are effective at stopping those. Now, certainly some virus is purely airborne and could get through a cloth mask, but if the load is so small, the chance of infection is also small. So in summary, there's very, very good data from large community-based studies that cloth masks are effective in large part to stop COVID, and masking is better than not masking.
And what I would add, this is Chrissy, Dr. Abella, is perhaps when we finish this call, we can reconnect with you and get the several studies that you've been referring to, not just on the masks, but on other areas as well, that we can then put up on our social media pages and on our website as well, so that people can look to those reports that you're referring to.
Yeah, happy to supply all sorts of resources to share.
Thank you. And I'll go back over to Connor, I think, for our last question.
Thank you so much. And yes, we have one last question, but I did want to flag a question that just came in that I think if we can ask you, Dr. Bella, really quickly from Gail. She was asking, with flu season upon us, should you get the flu shot before the booster or vice versa? Can you just quickly speak to that? I know there's a lot of concern given we're about to be in the more traditional flu season. If there is an order, any suggestions you might have for people to be thinking about as they prepare?
Yeah, it's a great question. I'll tell you first that this last year, the medical community across the state and across the U.S. was dumbfounded. We saw almost zero flu. It was gone. There was no flu season last year. And we think the reason why is everyone was masking. And so, you know, I'm not saying you shouldn't get a flu shot, but I'm saying that the risk of flu if you're masking is incredibly small. It makes me shudder to think how much flu injury to, you know, people's health, hospitalizations, going to work could have been avoided if we masked during flu season. Getting a flu shot and a booster shot are independent things. They sort of will activate different antibody production. I think as a general principle, it's good to have shots for anything spaced out by a couple of weeks. Now, that's not really a scientific statement. I'll be the first to admit when I'm sort of making something up. But that is the general recommendation from a lot of occupational health literature. And that's just because, really, if you get a vaccine, your immune system is revved up, you feel unwell. If you get a second shot on top of it until everything's settled down, you may just feel worse. It's not even clear it's dangerous. It's almost certainly not dangerous. But the general recommendation is if you get a shot of any kind, you can get the flu shot a week or two later or a week or two before, as long as they're spaced out. And I definitely recommend getting the flu shot. Even though we haven't seen flu, flu is easily preventable. The flu shots work. And so I do recommend that in addition to any booster shots that may be coming down the line.
Thank you so much, Dr. Bella. And thank you, Gail, for that question. Our last question today comes from Julie. Julie, you should now be on the line. Julie, do we have you?
Yeah, hello.
Hello, yes, I can hear you. What's your question today?
Oh, my question is about all of the healthcare workers that are burned out and upset about the vaccine mandates that are being made. How are the local health systems going to address the amount of staff that's leaving the hospitals so that while we have beds open, they're not necessarily staffed to work for them?
Got it. Okay, so the question is sort of about burnout and vaccines for healthcare workers. Awesome. All right, why don't we start with you, Dr. Abella, on that, and then we'll hand it over to Ms. Franklin, and then we'll hand it over to Representative Houlihan.
Well, first, thank you for that question and for the recognition of healthcare workers and the struggles we've been having. You know, healthcare workers have been under unbelievable stress and burden through this whole process. And I have to say, I am every day inspired and impressed by those who show up for work and show up and do their jobs. You know, none of us signed up to be in a military-like environment, that is to say, where our own lives are at risk. We signed up to help other people. But the great majority of healthcare workers have shouldered that additional stress and burden very successfully, and it's amazing. That said, it's going to be hard, and it is true that many folks are leaving. We're seeing a lot of nursing shortages, especially because nurses have a lot of fluidity. There's a lot of nursing jobs available, and they can move to safer outpatient clinic environments. So in many places, for example, in the South right now, there are big shortages in Louisiana and Florida and some areas. It's a real, real problem. Nonetheless, the vast majority of folks are indeed hanging in there. Probably the most important thing I can share on this call is I'd like to be action-oriented. What can we do? First, thank your healthcare providers. Recognition and thanks go a long way. But far more important than that, mask and support vaccinations. Healthcare workers, almost to every person, would all say, look, you know, thanks are nice. We appreciate a pat on the back. What we really appreciate is people following science, people following public health, and making our lives easier. Think of the firefighters who say, gosh, if everyone just put fire alarms and fire extinguishers in their house, our life would be better. It's the same sort of thing. It's especially demoralizing to physicians and nurses to see people push back against masks and vaccines, but then show up and expect care when they have severe COVID.
Thank you, Dr. Bella. And Ms. Franklin, anything you want to add to that in terms of, I know you are dealing with health workers every day, not just from a public health perspective, but our doctors and everyone, nurses in the Chester County kind of system.
You know, Dr. Abella covered it well, especially from a health system perspective. The only thing I would add is, you know, we have a health care organization, which is more of a collaboration, who is constantly looking at this for the last year and a half and has had some opportunities to, you know, do some training and other activities to help mitigate it. But I couldn't agree more with Dr. Abella.
Thank you, Ms. Franklin. And Representative Houlihan, anything to add on that?
Yeah, I think you guys both said it very eloquently in terms of the support that is needed mostly is to make sure that more people are vaccinated so that we can be protecting our healthcare workers, not just their health, but physical health, but also their mental health. I really truly believe that we're creating a generation of veterans of a different kind, of people who fought a war of a different kind. My brother is an ER nurse in Iowa, as is his wife. And he, as Dr. Abella intimated, is, you know, exhausted and frustrated by the fact that we really could be doing so much more to not have exhausted and frustrated frontline workers. And so that would be my request of all of you, is to do, you know, the masking and the vaccinations and the conversations that need to happen. I will also say that there is money in I'm sure you guys have been hearing the word, the reconciliation bill, for supporting healthcare workers and continuing to build out our healthcare workforce, because it has been depleted pretty significantly. And to take care of healthcare workers and their physical and mental well-being as well. And that's why we need that reconciliation package and that reconciliation bill. And that's why we need what's called the American Families Plan. So for those of you who are paying attention to what's going on federally, that would be an enormous help for those providers as well.
Thank you for that. With that, we come to the end of our question and answer portion. Again, just a reminder to everyone, our office has a policy that if we were not able to get to your question today, you will receive a call back from a member of Chrissy's staff within 48 working hours with an answer to your question or pointing you in the direction of where you can find an answer. We will definitely get back to you. We want to make sure we reach everybody on this extremely important issue. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Congresswoman Houlihan for closing remarks.
Thank you, Connor, and I want to thank Dr. Abella and Jean Franklin for their time once again this morning. And I do very much want to thank each and every one of you on the call for taking the time to be with us this morning, and lots of people on the line and lots of questions. Please remember that this office, my office, is your office, and please do always feel free to reach out to us with questions. We're trying to be a source of information and calm in a storm. From the beginning of this virus, we have all been in this together, and that certainly hasn't changed. I want to thank you again for joining one of our town hall series, and I hope to see you out and about in the district. And on a personal note, I would like to thank Connor Lounsbury, who has been our spirit animal through many of these town halls. Today is his last day and last town hall with us, and I couldn't be more proud and appreciative of him and for him. And with that, I'll say goodbye and thank you, and see you around our community.